Welcome to Amplify Your Process Safety, the podcast that provides the experience and expertise you need when it comes to process safety and risk management. Our hands-on approach will give you the insight needed, whether you're new to industry or process safety, in a role where you interact with aspects of process safety, or an experienced process safety professional. Join us in our mission to protect people, the companies they work for, and the communities where they operate by making process safety knowledge available to all.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast. I'm Rob Bartlett, and today I am joined by Molly Myers, and we are here to talk about a recently released CSB investigation report for the vapor cloud explosion that happened at the Yankin Majestic facility in Columbus, Ohio on April 8th, 2021. So Molly, could you maybe get us started off with going through some of the background for the incident?
Sure. Yeah, so the report indicated that Yankin Majestic is a coatings and resin manufacturer based in Columbus, Ohio. The company was founded in 1920, and the facility that experienced the incident was opened in 1954. There were about 180 people who worked at the facility at the time of the incident. However, the actual incident occurred on the night shift around midnight, so there were only about 21 employees on site at the time. 12 of them were working in the resin plant, 5 were working in an adjacent paint plant, and there were 3 maintenance technicians scattered throughout the facility. Part of the facility was regulated by the OSHA PSM standard due to them exceeding the threshold quantity of flammable liquids of 10,000 pounds, and that process that handled the flammable liquids is the one that experienced this release and explosion. The facility was not covered by EPA's RMP regulation because they didn't exceed the threshold quantity for any specific listed chemicals in that standard. The facility produced over 120 different products using batch reactions. They took place in agitated reactors that they called kettles. They generally operated at about atmospheric pressure. They were open to atmosphere through an overhead condenser system. There were raw materials added to the kettles, and then all of that was heated and stirred to create the desired reaction. Each of the recipes had slightly different materials in them. And once the reaction was complete, they would stop the heating and they would circulate cooling water through the system to cool the batch. And while they were cooling, they also added solvent to aid in cooling and adjust the physical properties like density and viscosity to meet whatever their final product specifications were. The solvent that was used in this particular batch that had a problem was naphtha, which has a flash point of 69 Fahrenheit. And also, very notably, the vapors of that are much heavier than air. So they have a tendency, when they are out of containment, to sink down to the ground and can spread quite a distance.
So they'll fall, they'll kind of billow, they'll keep spreading, and unfortunately here, probably find an ignition source. So let's talk specifically about this night in question. What happened to produce such a bad result?
Right. So they were nearing the end of a batch, and the operator had collected a sample to check the product quality and so forth. And while they stepped away to run the analysis, the agitator in the kettle stopped running. Unfortunately, there were no alarms. It just changed from green to red on the HMI, human machine interface. But there were no alarms, nothing to draw the operator's attention to the fact that agitator stopped. So the operator continued on with the batch. They added the solvent, started cooling it per normal procedures. However, about an hour and a half later, after he added the solvent, he was expecting it to have cooled to the right temperature, and he realized it didn't cool. So he started troubleshooting the system and realized that the agitator wasn't running. And so he went ahead and started the agitator back up.
So at this point, we've got hot resin being agitated, the agitator stops. So now we have hot resin and we're pouring colder naphtha on top of it, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So and I've got really super hot resin and I've got relatively cool liquid flammable naphtha on top of that.
Right. And also the densities and viscosities of those two materials, the resin and the naphtha, were very different. And so they wouldn't mix without physical agitation.
Without the agitation, sure.
So basically stratified.
Operator says, hey, wait a minute, my agitator is supposed to be going, hit the button. Then what happened?
Hit the button. And so that started those two stratified layers mixing, and the solvent came into contact with that hot liquid and very rapidly vaporized and started pressurizing up the vessel. Unfortunately, the gasket on the manway, which we'll get to later, started leaking. And when we say the pressure rose rapidly, according to some of the data that they tracked after the fact, it pressured up to about 4 PSIG from atmospheric in just 15 seconds. And in just a few seconds later, it was up to 9 pounds. And that's when the resin liquid and flammable vapor started leaking out the manway through that gasket. The pressure did not exceed the point at where the rupture disc would release to direct the material to a catch tank. Instead, it leaked out of the manway. So the flammable vapor cloud rapidly filled the room and created a white haze, which made visibility very poor.
I recommend folks go and take a look at the report. If you're curious about what such a vapor leak would look like in the plant, there's some very good pictures from their security cameras of that white fog starting to fill the room and how quickly it went from a little bit of leaking around the manway gasket to, oh my gosh, you can't even see the kettle anymore on the camera.
Exactly. And that's where the operator ran into problems in that the visibility dropped to near zero right away. And he tried to stop the agitator again that he had just started, but he couldn't find the button. He tried to hit the emergency stop, but again, couldn't find that emergency stop button in the haze, in the dark.
Yeah.
He was fortunately able to find his way to an exit with the help of another operator, and they did get out of the building. However, they weren't able to notify anybody else of the problem. There weren't any alarms. The flammable gas detectors did note the leak of flammable material, and they sent an alert to the process engineer. But because it was a night shift, that person was not on site, and there was no local indication or audible warnings to let people know that there was a problem. And once people started seeing this white vapor oozing out of the building, some people mistakenly thought it might have been a steam leak and went into harm's way to try and troubleshoot what was going on.
Wow.
So that was very unfortunate. As we talked about earlier, that vapor cloud just started oozing around until it found an ignition source. I think it was only about 45 seconds, but by that point, enough vapor had accumulated in the system or in the building and nearby that it found that ignition point and caused a large explosion that shook nearby houses in the neighborhood. That explosion also ignited additional flammable materials, leading to a fire that burned for about 11 hours.
Yeah,
Several employees had to run through flames to escape. The operator that was working that particular kettle, as I said, managed to evacuate. But a lot of the other operators in the area did not realize the problem until after the explosion. And so they were scrambling to get out. Many of them got burned in the process. After the explosion, they did a head count and realized that there were 3 employees missing. Firefighters managed to rescue 2 of those people who were trapped underneath parts of the collapsed building. There were a total of 8 people that were transported to a hospital with injuries. And then the next day, when daylight arrived, the firefighters were able to eventually find the last person who was fatally injured.
We talk about these incidents and, you know, it's easy to just focus on the numbers. But in this particular instance, I'm just struck by, I mean, imagine being those 2 employees stuck under the rubble.
Just,
you don't know what happened. You probably assume that you're going to die because the world just ended or something. And that's just such a nightmare scenario.
Right. And unfortunately, one of them was trapped to the point where they ended up having a leg amputated at the hospital.
Yeah.
So yes, it's very unfortunate.
It's tragic. Tragedies that don't have to happen. Okay. Right. And so I think the last thing we were going to cover was the damage and the facility issues.
Yes, it was significant damage to the facility, and they eventually demolished the entire facility over the next 18, 19 months after the incident. So it cost one person their lives, several people significant injuries, and shut down the entire facility. So very significant.
Yep. And again, we've said this before, you know, the CSB does a great job investigating these, which is why we want to get the word out there, because we don't want these things to happen. So,
right. Yeah, I mentioned that this started because of material leaking from the manway of this vessel. So why don't you run down a little bit about what happened, what led to that leaky manway, Rob?
Okay. So normally we have vessels that handle hot, flammable materials, toxic materials, whatever. And our normal operation, our goal is to keep the material inside the equipment. Well, obviously that didn't happen here. So what we have here is the fact that vessels that are not intended to exceed 15 PSI are exempted from ASME's boiler and pressure vessel code, the National Board Inspection Code, or the NBIC, as well as API, the American Petroleum Institute's standard number 510, which is the pressure vessel and inspection code. So in industry, when we have vessels that are designed and operated at pressures above atmospheric pressure, there's special things that we do to make sure that we build them in a way that will prevent them from leaking or from rupturing while we're using them or whatever. So if you're above 15 PSI, we have very specific requirements for that. However, if you are not operating at 15 PSI or above, you're what we call a non-code vessel.
Right.
And there's a bit of a gap there about how to build these and how to manage them and et cetera. So we'll come back to that in a minute here.
Right.
This particular kettle that we're talking about was built in the early 60s, and it was actually built as a pressure vessel. It had a maximum allowable working pressure, or an MAWP, of 40 PSI. However, over the years, a number of non-code alterations had been made. And at the point we're talking about here, when we had the incident, the kettle was no longer being maintained as a pressure vessel. So that means that there were not specific requirements that were being enforced because of the fact that the pressure could be above atmospheric.
Right. They acknowledged that they no longer needed it to run at 40 pounds and opted to essentially derate it or lower that maximum allowable pressure to less than 15 pounds. Yeah.
And that was done. And that was done in 2013. And they, as you say, Yankee Majestic elected to keep the kettle in place as a non-code vessel that would be operated at less than 15 PSI. Okay, so we've talked about the fact that there's no clear industry guidance here. Yankee Majestic removed the nameplate for the vessel, which would have basically allowed it to operate at 50 PSI. We're saying, hey, we're not gonna operate it to that, so we're gonna remove the nameplate. And then they added a note to their equipment files to document the change. And unfortunately, the rupture disc that was specified for that had a set pressure of 17 PSI, which was higher than it should have been. This is supposed to be less than 15 PSI, so there's no way you should have a set pressure of up to 17 PSI.
Right.
That being said, Molly, you already mentioned that the leak actually appears to have started at about 9 PSI. So, right. And as you said, the rupture disc never did anything.
Right.
So it's not really a factor in this, although it does point to the confusion that Yankee Majestic had about their vessel. And unfortunately, I'm sure that they're not the only, you know, company, especially as we have aging equipment in the industry. Mm-hmm. Other companies are going through this. I am sure there are other vessels because of, again, it comes back to because we don't have a lot of good guidance for non-code pressure vessels. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's fast forward to 2021. They replaced the manway. And because the kettle wasn't considered a code vessel, there's no evidence that they did any, let's just say that they did adequate design calculations to make sure that the new manway would meet the requirements. So CSB had one of their consultants do an engineering evaluation after the incident. Mm-hmm. And based on the manway design, it probably would have been suitable for pressures of about 5 PSI. unfortunately, in this instance, so we had a manway that was probably suitable for 5 PSI. We had a rupture disc, which was set at about 17 or so PSI. So what's going to go first?
Yeah, you've got quite a danger zone there between
quite a gap.
16 and a half. Yep.
Now to give them credit, right? So that they did an MOC. We preach this mm-hmm. to our clients all the time. Is that a change? We got to do an MOC and a PSSR for that. Right. They did an MOC and a PSSR, but they hadn't done any pressure tests after the modification mm-hmm. at all. And then to kind of compound the issue, when the manway began to leak during the initial batch run, mm-hmm. after they made this change, all they did was replace the gasket with a thicker one, do a pressure test, which according to what the report says, they did a pressure test to 4 PSI with nitrogen. So 4 PSI. So right.
And they said that was fine. It didn't leak at 4, so we're good to go.
It didn't leak at 4, so we're good to go. So again, now that was below the 5 PSI that the engineering evaluation suggested probably was the upper limit, but still way below our 17 PSI or whatever, you know, whatever that exactly. higher rupture disc was for. So let's see. Okay. So they said, oh, it passed our 4 PSI. We're going to keep going. So they continue to operate with that. One note I want to have here that it did say in the report, they noted that OSHA cited the company after this incident. They cited the company for not initiating an incident investigation for the leak during the first batch. So the hope right. would be, why do we do incident investigations? We do incident investigations to find out what's the root cause. Why did this either near miss or actual release and incident happen so that we can prevent worse things from happening in the future? Well, this is one of those times where we had an incident.
Yeah.
We didn't do the investigation where we could have learned a lot if we had gone through what we should have done. And then unfortunately, you know, this does happen, you know, in industry. It doesn't always lead to this sort of an event. So a lot of times people don't really focus on it. But the fact of the matter is that they had an early warning here and they didn't heed the early warning. So exactly. Those of you who are out there and listening, if you have near misses like this, I mean, in this case, you know, what OSHA's definition in PSM for when you have to do an investigation is it was either catastrophic or it could have reasonably become catastrophic. And whether it was or wasn't is irrelevant. Could it have reasonably been? Well, obviously, it could have reasonably been because the next time it happened, it blew the whole building up.
Exactly.
Okay. Yep. So let's get back to the details here. So we talked about the rupture disc setting. It was not where it should have been. There's several incident investigations over the years of burst rupture discs, which demonstrate that the system could reach elevated pressures, right? So mm-hmm. they're saying, well, we don't go above, we're an atmospheric vessel. So,
and they had some alarms and interlocks at like 2 to 4 PSIG, which is probably why they pressure tested it at 4. However, right. if they've been blowing rupture discs that are set, you know, approaching 15 pounds or slightly 15. Over,
yeah. yep.
then obviously they have some excursions that can go that high. But they overlooked that fact when they were evaluating that gasket on the manway.
Yeah. And, you know, when you were describing a point I wanted to make, when you were describing what happened during the incident and the operator tried to shut things down, tried to shut the ad, it wouldn't have made a difference. The pressure was already up. The rupture disc was not relieving. So the only way to get pressure out of that vessel was through that manway.
Right.
And you could have reduced the heat input or maybe increase the cooling that would maybe slow, but no matter what, you still got a lot of vapor coming out of that vessel. So mm-hmm. another thing that was pointed out was that the company did not have a proper MI program for handling alterations, which the manway change would be an alteration. Also handling the proper inspections and testing for this non-pressure code vessel. And again, most of the potential rag gap that you could use for this exempt this sort of vessel because it's below 15 PSI.
Right. So, yeah. So they were caught in kind of a difficult spot, but they should have still had some guidance, some information, some procedures as to how to handle altering and inspecting and using this vessel in a safe manner.
Mm-hmm. That's some of the direct reasons of why it was the manway that failed. Molly, I think the report mentioned a few other contributing factors.
Yes, one of them was related to this agitator. They had some interlocks to prevent starting a batch without the agitator running because it was clear that the agitator was essential for safe operation. But once they got into the batch, they didn't have any interlocks that would, say, prevent adding the solvent if the agitator wasn't running. They didn't have any alarms that would let the operator know if the agitator failed. So they were really missing some robust controls that should have been there since the agitation was a big concern. So that was one of their gaps. Also, they had some flammable gas detectors in the area that did note the fact that they had a loss of containment of flammable vapors in the area. Unfortunately, it didn't have any local audible and or visual indicators to let the personnel working in the area know that there's a problem. So if you've got something escaping and it tells your process engineer, okay, that might be handy, but they're not the ones that are in harm's way that need to know immediately. As we talked about, the explosion happened in like 75 or 90 seconds or something like that. That's not enough time for an operator to, you know, engineer to get a notification and then somehow activate an emergency response or an evacuation signal separately. That sort of thing needs to get to the people working in the area immediately. And so they should have had some warnings.
I was just going to, I don't mean to interrupt, but I was just going to point out that when we're doing, say, PHAs and we're looking at safeguards for some sort of incident like this, mm-hmm. and we look at administrative safeguards, oh, we have an alarm and then the operator can do something. Or I guess in this case, the engineer was supposed to do something. Something that we always ask is, okay, if the alarm goes off, does that person have enough time to stop the event from happening? If not, it is not an effective safeguard. And I would be curious to ask and to try to understand how the company thought that informing a process engineer, especially in an off shift, nights, weekends, vacations, holidays, how that was going to prevent from an LEL standpoint. LEL goes off, you've got an immediate issue right now.
Exactly.
So I'd be interested to know how they kind of defended that and what rationale they used. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that right in there, that is one of the things that we should be thinking of when we have monitors that are informing people as opposed to monitors that are interlocked to something. So sorry.
Right. Yeah. So ideally, you know, those would have had some action, some interlock action, but at a minimum, it needed to alert the personnel, and they needed to have an emergency response plan that informed the operations personnel what the hazards were and what their responses should be when those LEL sensors activated. Instead, their emergency response plan was focused more on fire response and how to deal with a fire and when you should use a fire extinguisher and that sort of thing. It did not talk about the fact that there could be a vapor cloud explosion and that you needed to evacuate immediately. The last thing that the CSB pointed out was that the employees were not provided with or required to wear fire retardant clothing when they were working around the flammable materials. If they were doing certain specific actions, they had instructions to wear upgraded personal protective equipment, PPE, but for their normal operations, they were not required to do that. And so a lot of them were in short sleeve t-shirts. Well, as we said, once the explosion happened and ignited a fire, these people were having to traverse through or close to those flames without adequate clothing, and that added to their injuries. If you would have had fire retardant clothing, it is not a foolproof safeguard, but it does provide a very short-term benefit to reduce burn injuries. And in this case, that could have lessened some of the severity of the injuries.
I always like to say with the fire retardant clothing that it can help prevent some skin-related burns, but we always have to remember it's not foolproof, as you say, Molly, because I can breathe in hot mm-hmm. air hot vapors, or I can breathe in flammable vapors that can ignite in my lungs. And that is a very painful way to go, but the FRP does help.
Right, right. So that's kind of what happened and some of the contributing factors. So what did the CSB make for recommendations out of their report?
Okay, so recommendations are, it's great to have the CSB do an investigation. We can find out what happened. Hopefully we can learn from it. But unless we do something with that information, unless we make changes, it doesn't really help us prevent them in the future. So in this case, they made recommendations to Yank and Majestic, and they also made recommendations to API and ASME. And to first go through the recommendations to the company itself, they had four of them. The first one was to update their mechanical integrity procedures for all of their process vessels, including those that are atmospheric or lower, and ensure that they adhere to applicable rag and gap for design, construction, and alterations. And I think in this one, we probably could say the alterations are the real important one, because that's what directly led to this incident. Number two was use inherently safer design and engineering controls to prevent process safety events. This is, if we have in a PHA, right, if we have a scenario that can result in something like this, a release of flammables, an explosion, death, significant damage, all that sort of stuff, we've got to go to inherently safer design or adequate engineering controls. We can't, it's not really defensible to rely on administrative controls for safeguarding these significant process right. safety events.
And in this case, so they were relying on the operator to ensure that the agitation was running at the whole time before they added that solvent, and that just didn't work.
No. Right. Absolutely. The third one had to do the LDL detectors, which we've talked about a little bit, but install detectors according to RAGAP and equip them with visual and audible alarms and provide training for the proper response to those alarms. You want the people that need to respond to have that information as soon as they can. And having it come up on your HMI and send a text to your engineer, that's not adequate. And the second part of that, as I said, provide training, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, it goes off. That goes off. What are we supposed to do? That goes off. That means that white cloud you see isn't steam. Don't go back into the building. That means that's probably flammable vapors, naphtha. I don't know what other solvents they used. Stay away. And then their fourth one is the FRC clothing, making it required for being in all operating areas that handle flammable chemicals, which is an industry standard. NFPA has, I don't remember which number it is, but has a requirement for that. I believe NFPA 30 has something as well as a whole standard for the FRC.
Right.
So those are the four recommendations to the company itself. Molly, you're going to go over the API and ASME one.
Yeah. So as we mentioned, these non-code vessels really fall into a known gap in the RAGAGAP standards. They don't cleanly fit into any of the categories for various reasons. The kettle type equipment is exempted from several different guidance documents. So CSB directed API to collaborate with ASME to develop appropriate design, construction, and alteration guidelines for these low pressure vessels. So that's anything that operates from atmospheric pressure up to 15 PSIG, which is where the ASME Section 8 code picks up, for anything handling flammable or other highly hazardous chemical service arrangements. They said they might want to look at putting that guidance into API 510 for pressure vessel inspections, API 572, or some other document if they wanted to create a separate new standard. And then ASME Section 8 should reference whatever that guidance document is for companies like Yank and Majestic that started with a code vessel and then they decide to derate. If it's referenced in ASME Section 8, they know that, okay, I'm dropping out of this code, and now I need to go to this other reference for how to handle managing that vessel in a safe manner. So both of those consensus bodies need to work together to come up with some guidance, because a lot of companies, Yank and Majestic is definitely not the only one that handles these type of vessels. And many companies are left kind of scrambling as to what do we do. And unfortunately, a lot of them fall into the category of Yank and Majestic saying, well, we're not covered, so we'll use our best judgment.
Don't have to do anything, or we'll just use our engineering judgment. And really, we need, and again, I go back to this is not included in the report that I saw, but with our aging facilities, this is something that I think is going to become more and more of an issue over the next decade. And hopefully we can learn from this tragedy to prevent that.
And thinking of learning, we read through the report and they had some suggestions for learnings and improvements, but we like to cover those in our podcast on a broader basis for what companies beyond Yank and Majestic, beyond the resin and coatings manufacturers, that anybody can take away from this report. So, Rob, why don't you start with some of those learnings and suggestions?
Well, I think the first one that we wanted to talk about was when we're doing our PHAs on these processes, be careful what you assume. Don't assume that the pressure rating that you have in your documentation is correct. Don't assume that what's listed on a P&ID is correct. Have somebody verify that the information from PSI to be sure that the scenarios are being properly evaluated. If you assume, we're never going to go above 4 PSI, then you're not going to consider whether or not you can have some sort of incident that could have it go above that. And, what would happen then? So just be careful when you're making assumptions. You know, we've got to make some assumptions in PHAs or else we'd be there all year. But be careful when you're making the assumptions, because as we heard in this one, assumptions were made over the years that probably, you know, kind of resulted in this.
Right. Right. Yeah. And sometimes it may be helpful to have somebody, process engineer or someone like that prior to the PHA go and double check some of the information, like your maximum allowable working pressures and things like that for equipment just prior to the PHA, so that everybody knows what that correct information is going in.
And also, one of the things, just to parenthetically here, is I'll say in the old days, you know, 5-10 years ago, you do a PHA, and before you do a PHA and you say, we've got a pressure relief device that'll protect us from this. And then we moved on. And now what we're really trying to do is, we have a pressure relief device for that. Okay, is it sized for this particular scenario? Because if not, how do we know that it's going to protect us? And if during the PHAs for this process, if someone had asked those questions, somebody at some point would have realized that we've got a mismatch here. We've got a problem. Mm-hmm. We've got the potential to have above atmospheric pressure in here. And that would be a bad thing. So, okay, what else we got, Ollie? What other things can we learn?
Inherently safer design principles. One of the key advocates of this was Trevor Kletz many, many years ago. And basically, it's looking at ways that you can design your process to make it so that variations aren't hazardous. And one of the things to think about, especially when you're handling flammable materials, even if you're only intending to operate at nominally atmospheric pressure, you might want to consider going ahead and specifying vessels rated for 50 PSIG, which can typically handle a vacuum rating as well. And it provides you a lot of inherent safety for unexpected pressure swings, both on the pressure side and vacuum side. And it's, you know, not a huge cost implication for, you know, small to medium sized vessels. And it does buy you a lot of safety. And then it also gets you out of this quandary of what do I do for these atmospheric vessels? Because if you rate it for 50 pounds, then it's clearly an ASME code vessel, and you have all of the guidance and engineering associated with those designs.
But Molly, those are more expensive. Yes, they are. And
slightly.
They also provide you, that's the slight extra expense of to buy it and to maintain it, inspections and all. You're buying basically not having this sort of an incident happen at your facility. So
Right. And as we talked about before, it, you know, cost someone their life and injured multiple people and destroyed the entire facility.
Yep.
So, yeah. You know, so. Paying an extra $5,000 to get that pressure rating on a vessel, you know, may not
seems
be
like
that
a pretty good
expensive.
Deal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like a pretty good deal. All right, let's move on. The next one is to utilize a hierarchy of controls to ensure that we have robust controls in place to prevent these catastrophic incidents instead of relying just on administrative controls. We talked about this earlier, but when we talk about the hierarchy of controls, interlocks always be administrative controls. So if you have a process where you're dealing with flammables or toxics, and you're dealing with, especially at temperature, high temperature mm-hmm. vessels like this or processes, you want to make sure that you've got some well-designed, robust engineered controls, not just trying to inform, alarming to the operator, making assuming that they're going to troubleshoot accurately and shut down the process or do whatever mitigative steps they need to do. That's a lot of assumptions that you're putting on that operator.
Right. And then the next one, as we mentioned before, LEL detectors. If you're handling flammable materials, make sure you have those in adequate locations to alert people if there's any sort of loss of containment. Ensure that you have audible and visual warnings to the local personnel, and cover responses in your emergency response plan and whatever operator training you have so that the personnel understand what to do and that they need to evacuate. They don't need to go check out and troubleshoot and see if it's a false alarm and that sort of thing. Make sure it's clear in your emergency response plan that they need to get out.
Absolutely. And not go back in if they think it's steam.
yes.
So let's see, the second to last one here is ensure employees are trained on all the hazards posed by chemicals being handled and how to respond to a variety of incidents and types of releases. You know, use your PHA, look at what type of equipment you have, what are normal sorts of failures that can happen, and make sure that your employees are trained on how to handle those. To prevent them if possible, but if it's not possible to prevent them, at least to allow the safe evacuation of folks to make sure that there are no casualties. I mean, at the end of the day, if we've got to have an event like this, the best way is to destroy the process, but save the people. So hopefully, if you train your folks on how to respond, that will hopefully raise the odds of that happening.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then the last one we wanted to mention is that if you're in a facility that handles flammable chemicals, you really should equip your personnel with flame resistant PPE. It's not a, you know, it doesn't fix everything, but it may provide them the few moments that they need to safely escape if there's an incident.
Yeah, especially if they're trying to escape from a fire or some sort of issue that's happening a little bit of a distance away, that little bit of protection from the infrared heat can be what prevents something from turning into a serious incident versus mm-hmm. just some minor burns. So,
right.
All right. So I think that is about all we wanted to cover, Molly. Does that sound right?
Yep. Yep. I think that was a good report.
Yep, it is a good report. As always with these, we do recommend that folks read the full report. We do, of course, recognize that they can be fairly long and difficult to get through sometimes. This report itself, it clocks in at 83 pages, but it's a page turner. And and it definitely has some good information. And those of you, I know we've got some earlier stage process safety type folks in the audience, and hey, you want to learn from the mistakes of others, and these are great opportunities for that. So, and once again, we thank the Chemical Safety Board for the work that they do, and tip our hats to them for another excellent report. With that, I guess we'll close. So, if you have a comment about the episode this week, if you have an idea for a future episode or any questions about anything process safety related, we'd love to hear from you. Send us a voicemail using the link in our episode description, or you can always shoot us an email to podcast@amplifyconsultants.com.
Yeah, and if you want to learn a little bit more about mechanical integrity inspections for these non-code vessels that operate less than 15 PSIG, we had an earlier episode, podcast episode 75, in which I talked with William McBride of Excel, a mechanical integrity contractor, about these vessels, these types of vessels, and how you should go about inspecting them when they kind of fall within the gaps in the codes. And so if you're dealing with a mechanical integrity program, take a listen to that episode. That might give you some guidance until the API and ASME get a chance to provide better guidance. Also, if you want an example of another incident report from the CSB that discusses the fact that administrative controls are not adequate when you have potential catastrophic consequences, listen to our podcast episode 69 or read the CSB incident report about the explosion and fire at AB Specialties Silicones. That's a very, very good example of another case where there was too much reliance on operator training and operator procedures, and they would have benefited from interlocks.
Okay. So again, we really appreciate the hard work done by the CSB with these incident investigations. And we just think it's vital that people learn from these mistakes so that we can hopefully make sure that they're not repeated. Just to give you where to go, obviously, if you have information about this incident or any other incident that they've investigated, you can always go to the website, csb.gov. And those of us in the industry certainly know about their wonderful videos. So definitely go and take a look at the video as well.
Yeah, there isn't a video for this particular one, but they do have several other videos of a lot of other incidents. And what they've been doing lately is issuing the reports, and then sometimes they come out later with a video. So stay tuned.
Yep, absolutely. So it's our goal here at Amplify Process Safety to save lives by partnering with companies that handle highly hazardous chemicals to create world-class process safety systems, because we believe that these systems will help prevent catastrophic incidents like the one we talked about today. So if you have any questions or if there's anything we can do to help you on your process safety journey, please don't hesitate to reach out. And for Molly and myself, I thank you for listening. And until next time, be safe out there.
We appreciate you joining us for this episode of Amplify Your Process Safety. Head to our website, amplifyconsultants.com, to find our show notes and other resources. Thank you for joining us in our mission to ultimately save lives by advancing process safety right here on Amplify Your Process Safety. Until next time.